Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Hello, my name is Gary Mansfield, and this is the Ministry of Arts podcast, where each week I'll be speaking to a different artist. Now let's begin by bagging these bongos. Hello and welcome to episode number 83 of the Ministry of Arts podcast. And before I tell you about this week's guest, I've just got to make you aware of two exhibitions I happen to be in. I know it sounds a little bit big-headed going straight into a podcast speaking about myself, but I've not been in an exhibition for 6 months, and two have just opened, albeit one online. So yeah, I'm going to take this opportunity to sing it a little bit loud. Well, the first is the online exhibition, which involves 20 artists commemorating 100 years of the Magistrates Association. The exhibition is called 100 Years of Justice, and it's looking at 10 related themes, both 100 years in the past and 100 years in the future. The artists involved are from all walks of life. There's even another artist there that got involved via Kersler Arts, which is the amazing charity that I happen to be lucky enough to be on the board of. I created an artwork for the future concept of justice. I created an open padlock which was made of tally marks. There was 36,524 in all, marking every day of the future 100 years. I created an open padlock because I was confident that by the end of the next 100 years, there'll be a new solution to imprisoning so many people. And by strange chance, the artist that was doing the past concept of justice was Francis Hodgson. Francis and I don't know each other, but both our work was fine liner on paper, and we was marking time with our pens. Francis's is 50 hours of community service. Almost as a punishment, Francis drew and joined thousands upon thousands of circles. With these circles, she's created a large organic mass, which pretty much had no other purpose other than to log her 50 hours of community service. You can see all of these artworks over on the website. As I said, it's a virtual exhibition, but it will go physical in October 2021. A long time away, but, you know, that's the way of the world at the moment. You can see the virtual exhibition at www.ma100yearsofjustice.com or over on Instagram, which is at ma100years. The second exhibition is taking part at the Spitalfields Townhouse, which is number 5 Fournier Street, just off Brick Lane. This exhibition features 30 artists, with all of the work having either a theme or inspired by Spitalfields itself. My artwork was, well, you've guessed it, a padlock made out of tallies. It was taken from a photograph of a padlock that I took on a locked door when I was at the Art Car Boot Fair a few years ago. This exhibition runs from the 12th of September until the 25th of October. And for more information, you can either go to townhousespitterfields.com or on their Instagram, which is also Townhouse Spitterfields. But let's get back to this week's episode. A few weeks ago, I put a call out for artists to contact me if they was free on a certain day, because I had a few hours spare and I wanted to record a podcast. Well, my friend and previous podcast guest, Elizabeth Waggett, got in touch with me and told me about her friend, Lyle O'Werko, who's got a story that I really need to get on Ministry of Arts. I'm afraid to say I didn't recognise Lyle's name, and knowing that Elizabeth wouldn't have mentioned him to me without good reason, I looked him up on Google. And oh my God, did I need him on the Ministry of Arts podcast. Now, Lyle is a Canadian photographer that has lived in several countries throughout his life. He's currently living in LA. And I don't think this is too much of a bold statement when I say that I'm pretty sure that everyone listening to this podcast has seen Lyle's work. On September the 11th, 2001, Lyle became responsible for capturing one of the most dramatic photographs since the invention of the camera. With panic and debris filling the air of Manhattan, Lyle, like everyone else, just thought it was a devastating accident. That was until the second plane was seen banking round to take direction into Tower Number 2. Time magazine showed Lyle's photograph of a fireball exiting all four sides of Tower Number 2 on its front cover. As an image, it's aesthetically beautiful. However, the actions that created it makes it one of the most powerful, harrowing, disturbing and thought-provoking photographs that we're ever likely to see. As any of you know that listen to these podcasts, you'll be well aware that I like to rabbit quite a bit. This was one conversation where I just sat back and listened. I mean, we've all seen the footage, we've seen the photographs, but when you just sit down and listen to the story from someone's lips who was actually there, it really is quite moving. And as I said earlier, this podcast was recorded about 2 weeks previous to the day this is being released, September the 11th. And it was only when I was speaking to Lyle that I thought of releasing it today. But I didn't know whether this was a day that I should bring it out or a day that I definitely shouldn't bring it out. So I asked Lyle himself. And Lyle said that this was a moment that should never be not spoken about. So please, come and join me when I speak to Lyle O'Werko. So where are you living at the moment?
I'm based in Los Angeles now. I was in New York City for over 25 years. Yeah. And finally reached the end of my tenure there, and needed new horizons just for both creative input and for creative output. My wife is from, her family's in the Bay Area. So we went to San Francisco first, and I had a studio in Oakland for 2 years that created a lot of new work that I could never have created in New York. It wasn't the most easy place to transplant myself after New York. And in fact, my horizons were Berlin. I'd been accepted to an education program in Berlin that I thought would be really interesting, would open some new doors. And love came to town. And
As it does.
I'd sold my apartment in New York and then met the woman who's now my wife, Carly, who's a painter. And after about a year in New York together, we thought, let's give San Francisco a try. It was a low barrier of entry. She already had an apartment in San Francisco. And so it made natural sense. Very, very different city than any city I've really spent much time in. I've spent a lot of time in London, a lot of time in Cape Town, and then stints in Nairobi as well as Rio, and always gathered a lot of energy from those cities and found their creative communities to really embrace me being in town. And the San Francisco community is just going through lots of changes, a lot of disruption, which was good to see another city in America from fresh eyes out of New York. But seeing Oakland as sort of like Detroit by the sea. People would say that it was like Williamsburg by the sea, but or Brooklyn by the sea, but I really felt it was like Detroit by the sea. And then ended up meeting artists and a creative community that I would never have come in contact with had I been in New York.
Right.
New York spoiled me. New York was very good to me. New York was very comprehensive in shaping me as an artist. And that's where I came of age. I moved there as basically like a teenager and then left as a man and went through 25 years of change, both with the city, both as a creative person, and then both as an entity together, because I accomplished things there that truly became indelible parts of the New York history. But to stay there and keep hitting the same note over and over and over again doesn't advance your career. Moving to California offered new horizons and really changed both my art and really changed my wife's art. She's preparing for her first solo show in Los Angeles. And the work that she was creating in New York is very different than the work that she's creating in California.
It's amazing how your environment can shift the memento of your work, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think it was always advocated for artists to change environment. I think environment is very important. I think that's why there's artist residencies around the world. There's artists, like you have a history in Berlin of like David Bowie, and the London David Bowie is very different than the Berlin David Bowie. And then there's even U2, who went to Berlin and recorded one of their most seminal albums at a time when the Cold War was turning over and Berlin was turning over. I think environment informs the artist. And artists have always had kind of slightly higher antennas. Like you can have two artists not communicating with each other in entirely different environments in the world. They may be friends of some sort. You might not talk for 4 or 5 years. You'll call each other up. You'd be like, you know, I just started painting with a lot of blue lately. And the other person's like, me too. I don't know what. But it's because the artist's mind really taps into an ether with these antennas and picks up information that other people aren't. And that can be these little scraps, because I think artists are like magpies. You're out finding the shiny objects and the interesting things, and then building your nest with it. And you never know what you're going to be getting that day, but it all becomes this knitted together structure that is your safety net that helps you incubate what's happening next.
Well, I've been recording for a few minutes now, as you're aware. Yeah. I should introduce you. Your name's Lyle Awerko. You're a photographer from all around the world, it would appear. And the first question I have is, how would you explain what you do to somebody that doesn't know your work?
The best phrase came from a client once, and she called me a creative anthropologist.
Oh, nice.
And that stuck. And I think it helps explain the bridge all the different bodies of work that I've done. I like to think that I work in a Kubrick-like manner, where each project is its own world. And if you look at the history of Stanley Kubrick as a filmmaker, each film is so different than the last film, but each has its own world, both technically that he created, as well as visually, as well as the actor choice, and as well as the storylines. Mm. And my work is all part of documenting the human condition. I think I come from a place of positivity. I don't believe the human dysphoria is a negative one. I think that we come from light. I think cultures come from light. I think cultures bleed into one another and inform and make for a greater whole. But within that uniqueness, I like to stop time. And the times I went to Africa, I was there for various different assignments and for very different reasons. One of the assignments was with the UN. I went there to work on a project that was a conjunctive bridge between Columbia University, the Earth Institute, and the UN, and it was documenting a village that they were introducing new, what they call technologies, but it was new ways to help these people empower themselves, both economically, socially, and environmentally, and teaching them how to introduce fertilizer into their crops to have higher yields, things that they hadn't been employing in their culture. And I spent a month there, went back to Nairobi, and I was going to head on to a trip to go meet some friends at a safari camp. And an old friend who I'd worked with, who'd had an ad agency that I'd done a lot of work for when I was younger, invited me to go north to see a project she was doing where I had been donating fine art prints to their auctions every year to generate funds for. And that's where I went and met the Samburu people. There was no agenda. They dropped me off on the side of the road in the middle of the night with my gear and a backpack and said, "Oh, these people are going to take care of you. We'll see you in a week. We've got to go to this other thing." And I'm literally standing there on the side of the road, and these two guys come over and they have feather mohawks. And I'm like, "You got to be kidding me. Like, no one prepared me for this. All they've been talking about was these school children." And these guys that were like literally like the Rolling Stones of the bush, like they were the coolest, neatest, funniest, most engaging, beautiful people you could imagine living in this part of Africa that hadn't even had a paved road go through it. And I just saw the beauty in them. We had so much fun. I just saw the beauty in them. And the portraits I didn't weren't thought out. They were just, "Hey, this guy is cool. He just walked into camp. Can we hold up the bed sheet and let me take his picture?" Two, three, four taps. And that was it. And I ended up doing, I think, about six trips to them and became just good friends and enraptured in their culture and the tribe and their ways. And in fact, five of them a few years ago came to New York for a fundraiser for that charity. Nice. And they stayed with me in New York in my loft, and my neighbors were like, "This is amazing! I knew they had to be with you." And my dog at the time was a pit bull, who was a very gregarious, outgoing creature. She was like, "What took so long for this to happen? Like, this is amazing! These guys can stay forever."
Yeah.
And I remember they all stayed in one room together, like they would in a campsite. And I went in and looked at my dog sleeping in with all of them laying on the floor, and she just kind of looked up at me, and I was like, "You're having the best time of your life."
Yeah. And what did they think of New York?
You know what they thought it was really funny, and seeing New York through their eyes with so much humor. And one of the things they thought was the funniest ever was big men with little tiny dogs on a leash. Whenever they saw that, they would laugh. They thought it so funny. And then being tribesmen in full gear, like full regalia, and then being in the subways and seeing like escalators and moving walkways were just the funniest things to them. Like they couldn't believe, why would you have a moving walkway? Like
I'm still full that myself.
Exactly. And so seeing New York through their eyes and also just, and they were culture warriors. So the thing is, never show fear anywhere. So they were confident anywhere, and they just want to go home. Like they were like, you know, it was nice to meet the crazy people and see the tall buildings and all the noise and that. But man, I can't wait to go back home to the bush and sleeping under the stars and taking care of my cows and my goats and being back with my family.
Brilliant.
And there's so much love and education that came through that, and yeah, and the lives, the people that they touched in New York, but how they were also like, you know what, I've got a great life. And
yeah, I'd rather go back home.
Yep. Enough with the crazy people. When I was traveling one time in Africa, I'd met this group of people from New Zealand at a camp, and they all traveled together. One woman, her husband was New Zealander, and he had served in Second World War. And he never came on any of these group trips that they all went on. He was like, left New Zealand, saw Europe during the Second World War, never need to leave again. And and there's things that you learn from that. But again, your question was environment shaping the artist. And it is good to get out of your comfort zone. The reason I left New York was it was a comfort zone that I could have maintained and lived in and functioned in for the rest of my life. But that would be hitting one note on the keyboard of life. I needed to move up the keyboard and hear different notes and experiment more. If I was a concert pianist in New York playing classical music, I needed to get out on the road and hear some jazz.
Well, I'm well aware that your work that was become well known from New York, you've obviously spoken about too many times, and this will be another, but would you be able to talk about the images you captured?
Yeah, it's 9/11 is my responsibility. It's a responsibility to articulate the experience, the capturing of those images, the sharing of those images in as gentle and as informative and as an educational manner as possible that I can. It's a responsibility that I carry, and I was given that responsibility. That responsibility came as an alignment in the universe I'll never be able to quantify or fully understand, because it was 1,000 minute decisions made in a very high stress environment with gear, with cameras. A lot of people in this digital world now, it's almost 20 years since those images were taken. Those were taken with film cameras. There was a different mythology, a different way of articulating how you shot. Now at my iPhone, I can go out and take 2,000 pictures with my son in the playground in an afternoon. Not a problem with an 8-megapixel camera that has a very good rendering. Then it was a film camera where you had to time your pictures. You had to think about it. An actor once asked me, what do I miss about taking pictures with film cameras? And I said, the breath I used to take before I hit the shutter.
Nice.
And he, I remember his head just kind of went, and he was like, that was not the answer I was expecting. And because most people are expecting a very technical answer. And I can see people taking pictures and watch their breathing and know the method behind gathering what they were gathering.
Yeah.
So that day wasn't about taking lots of pictures. It was about efficient use of the camera gear in a very high stress situation with being put in the position to tell a story that was history.
Yeah.
And as I've said to people in the past and in a particular project, there's moments when you're part of time and there's moments when you were part of history. Mm. This was a moment where I was part of history and I was the hands, ears, eyes of a greater purpose, which is to record something as honestly and as truthfully as possible.
Yeah.
I don't feel I have a sarcastic lens. I don't feel I have a mean lens. I've always tried to have a very diligent, truthful, and empowering lens, and to always use my lens to elevate. So in that situation, I think I captured something that was very dynamic, that was very cinematic, that was very hard to even believe. Like it's still, I look at the images and it's not like I was taking the images. There was a greater purpose acting through me to document things in as articulate and as gentle and as truthful manner as possible.
Yeah. I mean, how long was you in front of the towers, Lowell, from pretty much from start to finish?
Through the timing of it, I actually worked, I had to time out my photos with the fire investigators from the National Institute. They're wonderful. I think it's like the National Institute of Standards and Sciences, something like that. It's, forgive me for not knowing the name of it. I can look it up easily, but it's falling out of my brain right now. But they were the ones that put together the fire report on the buildings coming down.
Yeah.
And they had contacted me from Washington and came up to look at my imagery, and they placed that against a timeline. And they said, wow, first of all, you were moving really fast. You were thinking on your feet very quickly, and you thought in terms of a storyline.
Yeah.
And the first plane crash, I believe, was 8:47 a.m. The second one was 9:02. So I managed from 8:47 to get from my apartment on Broadway and Franklin in Tribeca to the World Trade Center site, document along the way, and be positioned in this place of spectacular truth to see the second plane come in. And I'd merely positioned myself where I was, right under the World Trade Towers, where I could get a photo of both of them. I would have the sun behind me, so they were lit really well, where I could juxtapose the two towers against each other. The one that was standing tall and brilliantly and defiantly, the other one that had just been shivved by a plane of unknown origin. And that was a great shot. It was like,
well, at that point, I presume you just thought it was an accident that had happened.
Yeah, a very odd accident on an incredibly beautiful, clear day.
Yeah.
But accidents happen in all kinds of situations that we can't determine.
I've seen the first photographs of yours when it looks like, the one that you're talking about, when it looks like you're standing right at the base looking up, when you're probably about, I don't know, maybe 100 yards away. But when you're looking up and you can see both of the towers, and then there's the famous one on front of Time magazine, where there is an explosion in one of the towers where the second plane was hit.
Mm-hmm. And I was positioned there and I saw the second plane. I actually heard it first. And my immediate reaction was, okay, they're diverting air traffic out of Newark. Planes are scrambling. You're like, there must be something going on, because at that point, my only understanding of the event was in real time.
Yeah.
A lot of people over the years said, oh, you must have saw it on TV and reacted. No, I was reacting to the sound of a plane crashing in my neighborhood. I'd just flown back from Africa. My camera bags were still packed at the front door of my apartment because I was lazy and didn't unpack the gear. And so I had my movement bag ready and film and ready to go.
God bless laziness, eh?
Exactly. There's something to be said. It's like there's that never clean your desk, because you never know what you might
exactly find,
at the moment of inspiration. And so there was, I reacted to the sound. Like, hey, a plane just crashed in Tribeca, reacted to the sound, I got to get moving, hit the road, boom, and followed a storyline that was unraveling in real time, of which the architects' true vision for this event was way beyond my sense of comprehension and the world's. And so happened to be in this position, heard the second plane, then I saw it and was like, wow, like the aircraft must really be scrambling.
Yeah.
And
was it the second one, Lowell, that banked around?
Yeah, that's what I saw it bank. And then when its wings were out, and then it tilted. And when it did that, then I knew its intention. It's just like a predator going for prey.
Yeah.
Like when you're all the time I spent in the field in Africa, and then in the years since Mongolia, where you're seeing an apex predator going after its prey, an eagle tucking its wings in, or a lion or a leopard going after prey, it has a certain set of machinations it employs in that purpose. Yeah. And seeing this airplane tilt its wings, pull this hard turn, and then it was like, okay, I see where this plane is going. And so I saw the plane, but I had a choice as a photographer. The particular camera I had in my hand would be about 1.3 seconds to rewind the frame. It was a medium format camera. And I made the choice to wait for the event, not shoot the plane coming in, because I couldn't quite manage the airspeed. I was like, if this thing hits, I have a choice to shoot it coming in or the shot of it hitting. That was the decision I made. Can't explain it. It was all made in literally hundreds of a second. Choices, but it's a choice I made.
And it's only experience that made you make that choice in the microseconds, isn't it?
Yeah. You're pulling from a bucket of things that have formed your life up to that point. Over the years, I've gotten a lot of exposure to different pro athletes, a lot of race car drivers, both in F1 and the NASCAR series, who you get to talk with, and they can't quite explain making those decisions that they do.
Instinct.
I've been fortunate to be exposed to some of those people. And so you have very interesting conversations, because there's your conversation, and then there's this ether between the words where you're like, I did something on a particular day on the earth in a particular set of circumstances that you cannot replicate. You might not even make the same choices again, put in the same situation, but nonetheless, I was there. I made a decision while all of this chaos was happening, and it produced a result. And I'm here to talk about it.
Yeah.
And
when you had the realization, Lyle, that plane that was banking, when you sort of realized it's very probably going to hit that other tower purposely, can you even remember that, like your feeling there, like the feeling that you must have had in your gut, or even in your throat, you know?
Yeah, I can conjure that feeling up in a second. It sits in a box inside my head.
Yeah.
You try not to go there, but say in a dialogue like this, I can go and open up the box. I can pull that feeling out, and it lives like a living, breathing object in my psyche.
Fucking hell, man.
Because the thing that you look at the photo, I look at the photo, I hear the sirens, I have the smells, the sounds, which I can't even articulate the sounds, especially the sound of a large commercial airliner hitting the side of a building and disintegrating into pieces in a half a city block. Like, how do you describe that?
Yeah.
I know that we have...
It's an illogical set of circumstances, isn't it? It's ones that, you know, only appears in a dream or a movie. You don't expect that in your neighborhood, do you?
Exactly. And I'm sure that, like, for all of us that got to experience the explosion in Beirut through social media a couple weeks ago, we have a lot of data, a lot of personal point of view. Then there's security camera footage, then the professional footage. There's a lot of different things that come into that place. And even though we have all of this information, we still can't quite grasp the magnitude of that, other than when they compared it to that it was the third largest explosion on planet Earth by man-made means known of since the Hiroshima and Nagasaki atomic bombs. Number three below that. This, for me, had that same sort of magnitude because of this punch. A commercial aircraft punching the side of a building with full force. They were full throttle. They weren't throttling down. They were throttling up when they fully aimed the aircraft. And I watched it happen and then took a picture. and as I figured that there would be some sort of explosion, I managed to capture it at its apex, and it's a very spectacular photo, but it still only tells part of the story. But it tells a very, very, very distinct story in the spectacular nature of the event. And that is a truthful articulation of the event as I could render. It's still a story that echoes in so many people's brains and hearts and lives, especially in New York, but it allowed the world to fully grasp the magnitude of the event. Mm. Much like we were able to grasp the magnitude of the event in Beirut through smartphones, recording with a fidelity that didn't exist 20 years ago when I took the picture of this. But I was actually shooting a medium format camera at the time. I had two cameras with me, 35 and the medium format. Medium format just happened to be the one in my hands. And so it has a very strong fidelity to it, especially, and then the type of film I was shooting. So, and the light, all the elements work together to create somewhat of a very distinct photograph. You can't say it's a perfect photograph. It's an imperfect moment rendered to the best of its fidelity. As a creative person, the goal is to create something that's significant, that your mortal coil is remembered beyond your lifetime.
Yeah.
That's the goal. Artist,
a seminal artwork.
Yeah. An artist seeks to define their life through their art and mark moments in time, whether they're Picasso reacting against the insurrections in Spain and creating his masterpiece, Guernica, which is a study on so many things, and it's all these elements coming together to create this grand story. Master's paintings always sought to render the moments of the times in ways that were important. And you have the Russian constructivists fighting against the oligarchy and at the times in their way through rendering through color and abstract blocks and assigning meaning to that. And I always set out as a photographer to really take cool pictures and define things. And then at the age of 30 to have a body of work that was someone who maybe lived two or three times my age was really overwhelming, because it was, are you familiar with Anton Corbin? He invited, he's such a lovely man. And I value every moment I'm given with him. We have mutual friends that connected us years ago. And I went to his survey of his career in Holland. There he had dual exhibitions in The Hague. And he invited me, and I was like, oh, I gotta go to this. It was about 4 years ago. I jumped on a plane and flew there and made it. My flight was delayed out of London and made it there just in time to the opening. And was sitting at this table, and it was the director, I believe it was Photography Museum in The Hague, and the director of the museum was like, what are you doing here? Why do you fly from New York to know this gentleman that we're honoring tonight? And Anton's like, well, this is my friend Lyle, and he did this and this, and you probably know his time cover image from 9/11. And the director of the museum went, well, it's all downhill from there, isn't it?
Well, what can you say to that?
Of course they're all like over 6 foot tall Dutchmen in that way, in that very non-plus Dutch way about going about the world and having some dark humor to it as well. And then sitting and explaining to him where I was with my career, because that gave me liberty to go do other things. You're never going to replicate that, so why try?
It's like winning an Oscar on your second movie.
Exactly. And so don't keep taking the same roles, hoping for a repeat. Really challenge yourself. And so as I evolved as a creative person over the next decade, I sought out not more conflict, not more disruption, not more hate, not more anger, not more tragedy. I sought out projects that would take me to different environments of the world and find joy.
Yeah, the images you captured of that day and that day itself, did that change the way that you approached your work?
Yeah, it changed the way I approached my work, but it opened my heart bigger.
Yeah.
It made me more of a compassionate person, but at times more intolerant. I can admit maybe at times I had a short temper and yeah. Intolerant of BS, yeah. Intolerant of showboating, intolerant of things that were flaccid or lacked soul.
Yeah.
That, I have friends in entertainment directors and I was in South Africa with a group of creatives one time, and they were a bunch of surfer friends as well as creatives, and they were hacking on me, just hanging on, like just whatever they just were beating me down. And finally I was in the car with one of the other guys who didn't know me, and we were driving along, and he goes, for 3 days I've watched these guys just beat on you, like, not give you an inch on anything. Yeah. And he's like, what is up with this guy? Like, why would he tolerate this? And then finally they were like, oh no, like he's done all these amazing things.
Yeah.
And we're just trying to keep him honest.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And then he was like, he goes, I had no idea. Like, this was your career. I thought you were just this like poor tag along with this group. And Excellent. And realize that you could take that from them. But there was also them keeping you honest and grounded. And there's that phrase like not suffering fools easily.
Yeah.
And maybe there was a time that I was much like that, where it was like someone be like, blah, 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 me, blah, 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 I've done this, blah, blah. And I'm like, yeah, right. Like,
well, it must have had that same or a similar effect to loads of people, loads of New Yorkers at that moment, at that week, that month, or, since then. So many people must have changed the way they thought and looked at the world.
Yeah. Yeah. And then there was a lot of people not really knowing how to look at the world after that. And also I understood that my moment was like Everesting. I went to Everest. Other people had stories that put them on top of a mound, so to speak. But because I was lucky enough to have a very, very, and I say lucky because I'm able to articulate my experience through a picture,
yeah,
or a group of pictures where I can say, this is what I experienced that day. I can talk with you. We're talking about that experience. It's very tactile. There's a lot of other people whose experience is very psychological.
Yeah.
They're caught up in their heads.
Because your main image, which was on Time magazine, which had the two towers exploding, was obviously, very dramatic, very loud, but the harrowing, or the ones that was equally as harrowing, were the silent ones that you captured of people falling or jumping from the tower that initially we all thought was debris falling down. And it happened to be people that chose to make their own destiny or what have you.
Which is my choice in those moments when I did take those pictures, and I remember the collective gasp of people when they really realized that those were people jumping, was I was capturing those people in their last moment of life, not their first moment of death.
Yeah.
And that if I didn't take those pictures, history wouldn't remember them. And those were very hard pictures to take. And they still are. I didn't click the shutter for many of them. There's many things that I did not click the shutter of that day, because I didn't need that memory. Yesterday I saw a person must have just deceased. Police pulled up and put a sheet on someone sitting on a bus bench while we were at a traffic light. Mm. And I didn't even tell my wife about it last night. I didn't even take a picture of it. It's like that person needed dignity, and that was their last moment of dignity. It doesn't need to be my moment of kind of spectacular rendering. Like I didn't need to elevate my life experience or make my day more important than anyone else's day or more horrible. Like that person was already experiencing the ultimate, which was their soul leaving their body. And when I took those pictures, I could have taken more, but I tried to render people in almost an angelic, graceful moment of carnage and ballet intersecting. And so that future generations can go back and see and be like, that person made a choice of dignity, not a choice of indignity.
Yeah.
And as history goes forward, there may be better scanning techniques. There may be better reconstruction techniques where maybe some people may really be able to have closure with someone they lost because they're able to go in and determine, hey, that person was wearing that day they left the house, they're wearing khaki pants and a blue button down and a red tie and or a chartreuse tie. And we went culled through these images, which are artifacts of history. And we now know what happened to uncle's X or aunt, you know, Y or cousin Z, you know, and that's important moments of history. And that's what I've always tried to do with my work. It's every day is the same thesis. Every day is not the same, but the thesis is the same. Go out and contribute something epic, create something epic, shoot something epic. One day it may really be important to history. The other day it's not important to anyone.
Yeah.
But it's still under the same thesis. So every project is about elevating the human condition, creating multiple avenues of metaphor. I've done more PR about the Boombox project, more interviews, more focuses on what I'm doing with the Boombox project than I ever did with 9/11.
Wow.
And that's strange, but it's also interesting because the two stories enmesh. Like we are talking today, the stories are enmeshed. Boombox Project was my love letter to New York City. It was seizing on this object that was a very disruptive element in culture, but it was able to help people articulate their condition and to become an artist, to become valid, to bring their voice to the table, to have show something with swagger and defiance and beat and rhythm and hubris and virility and all of those things together. And the Boombox became, for me, was like, okay, if 9/11 is really contributing to the bricks and mortar of New York City as this remarkable place where people gathered and then at that particular moment went through a supreme tragedy together, how about find something else that brought people together in New York and help create a beat and a rhythm that now rotates around the world? It's as New York incubated hip hop is now a very important language around the world. It isn't just rap. It isn't hip hop is an ideology based on youth and community and gathering and battles and saying what you say and humor and all of that. And so the Boombox became, if 9/11 opened the door for me to have a voice, the Boombox Project became the vehicle for me to project what was going on inside of me and why those images exist. And sometimes people are like, wow, you're jumping all over the place. You're doing that. I was like, no, listen to this. And they're like,
there is a link there somewhere.
Ah, there's the link. And also the Boombox Project was my way to deal with PTSD.
Yeah.
Was do something fun. Made me laugh, made me happy, makes other people happy.
Just give us a brief synopsis of what the Boombox Project was. I mean, I've seen it and I've got a couple of questions here about it, but could you just explain the visual side of the Boombox Project?
It was really simple. One artist at a dinner party thought that he would put me in my place, said, explain the Boombox Project in one sentence.
Okay.
And I said, it's my soup can. and he said, you MF-er. like F you. I thought I had you in a corner. And it just came out. It was like, my soup can. And the soup can for Andy Warhol was the backdrop to all kinds of things. Consumerism, yeah. Mass consumption, mass production, the flatlining of cuisine, the American way of better, bigger, faster, more, you know, the soup can resembles profit. It resembles corporations, all of these things. So for me, the boombox project and a boombox as it stands represents freedom and disruption and youth and noise and friction with your neighbors, your ability to broadcast, because up till then you were under the sort of control of the media companies through these large stereo systems that sat in your parents' house. And if you wanted to blast music, you needed a car. If you lived in the inner city, you didn't have a car. You couldn't afford a car.
Yeah.
A boombox was freedom. And
freedom in the 80s.
Exactly. And then it was a way to curate your experience. So you could make mixtapes. Yeah. You could put your favorite song over and over and over again and walk down a block playing your favorite song over and over and over again till you got a reaction that you wanted. It was a tribal drum. It was a singer-songwriter's Martin guitar in the 1940s. It was like what the acoustic guitar to Bob Dylan was the boombox was to Public Enemy. Yeah. Like, that's important. And so the visual of it was kind of not ever quite thought about. And then I had this idea, it's like, my drive as an artist is make things for me. I like making things for me. I'm not thinking of street art's popular and Scribbles. I'm gonna do Scribbles and Stencils because that's hot right now. Or yeah. I'm gonna subvert the logos of major corporations, high-end brands, and mix it with popular cartoon characters. I'm going to create things that are for me that I really like. And if you have conviction about what you're doing, sooner or later, other people will pick up on that conviction.
Yeah. Imagery, Lyle, or was there sculpture there as well? Because I've seen a blue boombox, and I've seen like a cerise pink boombox.
Yes, and I had a really fortunate experience with one of my clients. We both happened to be in London at the same time, and his wife is a musician and had her schedule was packed, and he was in London with her, and I happened to be in London at the same time, and through a mutual client of his, we were able to go visit Damien Hirst, and we thought we'd go have a cup of tea with Damien, look at a shark, get out of his hair. Yeah. And so we drove out to the English countryside and went and met this incredibly lovely, gregarious, upbeat, happy, funny, self-deprecating character for lunch who's there with his best friend. Yeah. And so the four of us had lunch together and we laughed and laughed and laughed and then ended up spending the day together. And the pinnacle being making a whole bunch of spin paintings together. Excellent. and then going to his foundry and then him going, wow, this boombox thing you got to make sculptures, man. Like, just go for it. He's like, make a 12 inch tall one, send it to me. I'll give them to these guys. They'll scale it up big. It'll be great. I was like, well, I just had a master class with the master. He said I can do sculptures. So why can't I do sculpture? Yeah. So I ended up creating my own boombox, and it was great because it was the next departure, having chronicled a number of the ones you could go on forever, like Closed Door.
Yeah.
I did that.
It's never ending.
Yeah. Time to move on. I was like, hey, the boombox is kind of like, again, like my soup can, my dog, it's my muse. And it's time to render it in new ways and experiment with lighting and working with now these sculptures where I'm shooting them with this really heavy force perspective and then framing them on a forced perspective. So, and also to work in 3D is a totally different brain thing. But I think as a photographer, I always worked in 3D too. I was always thinking about what the back of the picture looked like. I was always thinking about what existed beyond the frames. I was always looking at bringing things into the frame that worked in a three-dimensional manner. Yeah. And then maybe that's what made my work always quite cinematic, because I was informed by movies, by motion, by great cinematographers. And sculptures, I can't say like I've been following the path of the masters, but I've been following this path of self-generated objects of value, a self-generated object of pure beauty.
Definitely. When was your first interest in art, Lon?
Oh, from a kid, like tiny. I was always scribbling, but also how growing up in a little small town in northern Canada, art was just not understood. And again, like you would see things in books, or you look at Jackson Pollock's, and people would be like, "Oh, it's just, you know, toss paint on a canvas. What does that mean?" And so art for me was brought up under this thing that art was about perfect rendering of something.
Yeah.
Like, well, he could draw that horse like the horse looked, or he could draw that car exactly like the car looked. So that was art. And it's taken me a long time to unlearn that.
Yeah. And that's what I thought initially, that a good work of art was technically amazing, and a great piece of art goes beyond that, doesn't it?
And that's the next stage for me, is going to sculptures was a way of removing the reality and moving more into fantasy and more into fantasy rendering. And that's where I'm going more and more and more, is getting out of reality. And who knows where I'm going to end up with it, but I think I've got permission, and I don't, I have to evolve. Yeah. It's like 9/11 chapter, not the full book. Samburu, Mongolia, the work for the UN, other social documentary stuff, other street photography in New York, all chapters, not the full book.
Yeah. How do you relax, Lyle?
I spend time with my son now.
Nice. I've seen that.
That is one of the most relaxing, biggest gifts I've ever had, and I had no clue. It's amazing how you can 4 hours of sleep and you can sit with him and you're like, you're the best thing ever.
Amazing, eh?
Yeah.
One of the questions I have got now is, if there was you and five other artists, past or present, what would your ideal group show be?
Who can, it would be the most colorful black and white show.
Excellent.
It would be a group show of significant black and white imagery that froze time.
Nice.
It's, it could even be like, you know, friends, family, husband, wives, and, you know, lovers and friends.
Yeah.
And a group show of black and white photography with a connective tissue was the rendering of the human experience in his highest fidelity of manner. I love Roger Ballen and the darkness that the journey dives into. I can't go that dark, but he has given us a lot of permission to go that dark. Yeah. And his story is really fascinating, being this journeyman. I think he was an engineer in South Africa, but was going to these mining camps and taking pictures. Sebastian Salgado, exact same way. He was an economist working for the UN, and the camera became his way to tell the story bigger. I admire both of their black and white work. I admire the black and white work of Avedon, obviously, who's an icon of black and white photography. Anton Corbin, how he taught me what you could do with color and black and white before I'd ever met him. Like he gave permission to remove stuff from the picture, to put things into darkness.
Yeah.
Because in the darkness, you've got to see more of the character. I never really gravitated to the commercial photographers. It's always been the, like, Avenant. He worked for the Port Authority in New York as taking basically passport photos of people coming
wow,
into
I didn't know that. Asylum.
That was his beginnings as a photographer, was taking pictures of people who arrived at Ellis Island.
Wow.
Every day, pictures all day long. And that's what informed that style he has, the path,
yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And so none of these people set out like, I'm going to be a great photographer. It's Avedon spent all his time in the studio and then said, as a fashion photographer, was like, I'm going to get out of the studio and shoot the Paris collections in the street.
Yeah.
Well, what are you thinking? And I'm going to make the models jump and not stand there. It's like, what an architect of thinking. And people put Avedon on a pedestal, but they hadn't even got to thinking of how genius he was. Like, he was smart, but he wasn't, like, he's not even fully there. And I remember I was lunch with Steve Frankfurt, who's the famous New York art director, creative director. Look him up. He was 32 years old. He was named president of Y&R in New York. He did movie titles. He did advertising. And he and I used to go and have pancakes in New York and sit in a diner in the Upper East Side. And he would be like, talk to me about how when he worked on creating Sesame Street or creating gerbil tubes, all the toys that he came up with Mattel. And he also did the opening title sequence for Superman, for Alien, for his first one that he ever did was for Kill a Mockingbird. Like, the guy's career, and he was the most humble guy ever. Like, he looked at being creative, like, as a service to humanity, like being a plumber. Like,
yeah.
I just show up and do a job. You know, so of course I've got to come up with good ideas. I've got to come up with solutions to this.
It's my job.
He was no joke. And those are the fun. That's why you live in New York, for those spontaneous moments.
Yeah.
If I see something I like now, I'm like, damn, that was good. I even did it this morning with a photographer, Joey L, who's obviously I think he's in Rwanda on assignment. He posted this beautiful portrait. And I just, you know, gorgeous portrait, Joey. Like, yeah. Like, because he's pushing me. Like,
yeah, nice.
And that's the way it's got to be. Unfortunately, technology is, which I advocate, has created much more of a democracy of imagery. And right now, after we've done this interview, we've been on for about an hour, more pictures were taken in this hour in the history of humanity than were taken last century entirely.
It's amazing.
And you think of that. So the goal then, which for me as a creative person, was not to take more pictures, was to slow time down and to take better pictures.
Nice.
And it's kind of a summary thought now that we've had this conversation, but it's where I leave things off, because as I go forward as a creative person, it's not make more, it's to make better.
Yeah.
And
beautiful.
And that's what I challenge the generation below me, because you can go on Instagram and find some kid who's got a million Instagram followers and people are like, oh, we love it, love it, love it. But will they remember the pictures they watched on his Instagram feed 2 years from now? Will they even remember? Probably not. So the point is not more, it's just better.
I agree totally.
And that's where I'm at.
Well, what would you like to be, Lo, if you wasn't a photographer, if you wasn't an artist?
Probably a sailor.
Oh, nice. Good answer.
I've had remarkable experience with some of the top sailors just through racing, being able to be invited to document some racing. And I remember it's an informed a way of thinking for me for the rest of my life. And we were in a race. The gentleman was captaining the boat, was president of a sail manufacturer. And the particular boat we were on was acting up. We were right in this bucket race, and the choice was to tack out, follow everyone else, or to run between the spire and the cliff sides of an island. The captain was talking to his tactician. His tactician said, "We've got enough depth to make it between that spire and the cliffside. We're not going to rip the keel off." The choice was, do we destroy this boat or pull this tactical move? Split second, captain looks at the owner of the boat and says, "We have this choice, tacked out or run there." You could see the crews on the other boats being like, "What are these guys doing?"
Yeah.
Right between the rocks.
Excellent.
Saved all that time. Boom, 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 win the race. One of the guys was like, "What did you think of that?" And I said, "Well, you know, sometimes in life you got to zig when everyone else is zagging." But that's because as a photographer, I'm an observer.
Yeah.
And if I wasn't doing this, it would be doing something else that provides the ability to test your sense of observation every day. I think being on a sailboat would not be a bad delivery on that.
Perfect answer that ended this podcast just on time. That's all my questions asked. Lara, where can people see your work, be it social media or website?
Yeah, social media's Instagram is my full name, Lyle, LYLEOWERKO on Instagram. And same with my website, lyleowerko.com.
Brilliant. Lyle, this, I've got to say, this is the quietest I've ever been on a podcast. I've just sharpened listened to you because it was absolutely amazing. Your experience, what you went through, what you documented for everyone to see for now and in the future. It was amazing, man. Thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you. This is a real pleasure, a real fun way to end the week. Take care. Thanks, brother.
Thank you, Lyle. Well, there you go. Lyle Owerko. That was one incredible conversation. And as I said in the intro, no matter what their reasons were, the ramifications of that act are still being felt 19 years later. This is one of the few times when I really do regret not having a wider vocabulary, because I really haven't got the fucking words to describe the amount of loss, destruction, heartache and absolute fucking devastation that was caused when them two planes hit those two towers. I'm not going to go into the politics of it, because fuck the politics of it. And I'm not going to talk about the fucking financial cost of it, because it's only the governments who are worried about the financial cost of it. There's towns, cities and even countries that have been devastated in retaliation from this. And Lyle Owerko just happened to capture a thousandth of a second in a moment of time somewhere near the start of this story. As artists, we all want to capture our little moment in time. Some people's moments in time is just a little bit more incredible than others. So Lyle, thank you for your time. Elizabeth, thank you for the introduction. And like I say every week, on whichever platform you're listening to this podcast, you should be able to leave a comment. If you could do that, that really would help us to get noticed and anybody else looking for an art podcast. So, thanks again for listening, and until next week, ta-da.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.